You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Yale professor Jacob Hacker, author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, on his latest proposal, Prosperity Economics, Building an Economy for All, that he co-authored with Nathaniel Lowenthal of Yale University. I should also say Winner Take All Politics, co-authored with Paul Pearson, who we had on this program probably 2 years ago when the book first came out. Close to 2 years ago. One of the very first interviews that we did on this program. This version of the program. Also on the program, probably in the better half, we're going to take what we learn from Professor Jacob Hacker about making and developing an economy that provides broad-based economic opportunity for as many people as possible, and apply it to a conversation with the guy who agrees with Rand Paul on politics. I mean, on economics. At least in one narrow instance. I mentioned this the other day. We had like a little Twitter battle. I thought he was still a candidate for Congress. It turns out that he was running in the Democratic primary and lost. But still should be an interesting conversation. Also on the program today, in China, riots at a Foxconn factory. Foxconn, of course, massive factory employing, off the top of my head, I can't remember, but something around 80,000 workers, I think it is. And they are one of the primary makers of at least parts for the iPhone, Apple products, also Dell, I think, and Microsoft. And there were riots today there. We will get into that later in the program. Also, some fascinating statistics on just who is, or I should say, who is the support? Who is providing the support from white working class voters for Mitt Romney? It sounds like you should know the answer to that question, but it's a little bit more nuanced than that. Fascinating stuff. And just one more reason why Mitt Romney will lose this election. And a story I missed from a couple weeks ago about vouchers coming out of Louisiana. Also, a couple other sundry stories. This one, rather disturbing, about voting laws and who they will deter in this election. We'll have to get to that when we return. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Jacob Hacker.
Yeah.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jacob Hacker. He is the director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies and a political science professor at Yale University, author, co-author with Paul Pearson, The Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, and also author with Nathaniel Lowenthal of Yale University of Prosperity for All, a Prosperity Economics, Building an Economy for All, a set of policy recommendations. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me on, Sam.
So let's get into how to contrast your recommendations with what seems to be the only problem our political establishment in this country can focus on and can conceptualize, and that is the debt and deficit. Tell us why the debt and deficit is not the primary problem that we're facing right now, and what prosperity economics, how it addresses what our real problem is.
Yeah, I mean, so we have had now, you know, 4 or 5 years in the wake of the financial crisis in which very quickly all we've talked about is the looming deficit, the degree to which we're going to be facing these big problems in the future if we don't tackle it. And I mean, I think that's really a fundamental error. I mean, first of all, we know that in the current crisis, you know, in the downturn with jobs still really scarce, that efforts to try to cut back immediately are going to be very bad for the economy. But even thinking long term, you know, putting the deficit front and center is really putting the cart before the horse. I mean, when we've addressed the deficit effectively in the past, we've done so through increased growth and employment that brings in tax revenues and gets people into jobs where they're paying taxes. And second of all, we've done it through really thinking seriously about what the priorities of the nation are. How are we going to invest in the future? What are the areas where we want to put our tax dollars? What are the kind of rules we want to have in place for financial markets? And, you know, we just short-circuit most of those discussions by putting the deficit at the center of the debate.
What is, theoretically, the dangers of, or the inefficiencies, I guess, of carrying of operating at a deficit and carrying such amount of debt?
Well, I mean, economists will tell you that there are two primary dangers of running deficits. You know, one is that you're paying interest on the deficit, on the debt, and that crowds out other things. And the other danger, you know, the more fundamental danger, is that if you're running a deficit, you're raising interest rates, and that's reducing the private sector economic activity. Now, the first thing to say about that is that, you know, we are paying interest on the deficit, but the fact is that, you know, we're facing the problem we face is really a long-term one. It's runaway healthcare costs in particular, and, you know, that sort of deficit interest cost is not the central issue. And then the second front, I mean, I think everyone should recognize that interest rates are right now at record lows, and that we could make pretty substantial investments in areas that would pay off in the long term, like human capital investments. We call on in the report you mentioned, prosperity economics. We call for investments in pre-K education and college education, and investments in our infrastructure, which is completely falling apart. And all those kinds of investments have really substantial long term benefits. And then we really have to figure out, as we argue in the report, how to simultaneously rein in healthcare costs and make sure that we build on the advances of the Affordable Care Act to try to get more people coverage. So, you know, I would say that right now I think a lot of the deficit hysteria is driven by a kind of false equation of what's happened in, say, Greece with America's future, and as if there's just going to be this day of reckoning in which all of our creditors are going to collectively decide they no longer want to put their money into U.S. treasuries. And that's, you know, there's a non-trivial risk that if we were to run, you know, massive deficits year after year after year, that would happen. But it's just not a realistic concern right now. More likely, if you look at the way in which business leaders and investors are behaving, what they're really concerned about is that there's no real strategy for long-term growth, and that's really the issue, not the deficit.
Yeah, I want to get into the politics of that, because that
in just a moment, because that is, it's a stunning development in some respects.
Yeah.
And it seems to be completely inoculated from empiricism. And I want to talk about that, but before we move into that aspect of why from a political sense the deficit is such an obsession, I want to just turn to sort of this notion of what has been impacting growth in this country and genuine growth, or just even the definition of, I mean, because ostensibly we've been covering up for a loss of or stagnating wages in the middle class via bubbles, easy credit bubbles, and essentially just more people in the household working. But what I want to get to the idea of what constitutes growth. I mean, this debate over what is legitimately growth,
right?
You know, whether it's,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I think it's one of the interesting features of the present, of the debate is that you can get this sort of fetishism of growth. People will say we need to grow. For most Americans, they like the idea of growth in middle class living standards, but they look at the last generation, they see that they sort of have reason to believe that productivity increased, that corporations got richer, that those at the top got richer, but they recognize that a lot of those gains were very concentrated, and that, as you said, there were a lot of negative aspects of the way in which we grew, especially in the 2000s. This was jobless growth. It was growth in which we saw stagnation on a lot of things we care about, like, the most striking is that recently we've just discovered that the least educated Americans, white Americans, have seen a decline mm-hmm. in their longevity. That's just stunning. And we saw over that period workplace health insurance decline, people didn't have secure retirement pensions. We saw, stagnation of upward mobility, maybe even a decline, people not rising up the income ladder. So, people rightly ask, what do you get from growth? And if growth just means gains at the top, or if it means, this binge of borrowing that leads to a financial crisis, then they're rightly skeptical. So if we're going to have growth, it's got to be growth, and we need to have growth. It's got to be growth that's sustained, that's broadly shared, and that's built on investment in people and productivity, not on, short-term at borrowing and financial chicanery, which I think is entirely realistic. I mean, this is not abstracting from our political system, at least, it's entirely realistic. I mean, I think the real problem is politics, that, these are not hidden, what we write about in prosperity economics are not like hidden sources of growth. They're sort of the tried and true methods that have been, that we've known about for a long time. And they recognize, the fact that we know that the biggest returns come from investment in human and physical capital. We know that the United States is going to have to get more kids into, and especially through college, make sure that they have enriching pre-K options, that we get our schools to produce, broad gains across the distribution of income and across different groups. I mean, so those are not, and we've got to figure out how to fund that. And we don't have a sustainable financial, fiscal system where we have the richest of Americans, the richest class the world has ever seen, paying tax rates that are sometimes below those of the people who work for them, and sometimes, as we've learned with Mitt Romney, below the even those of the upper middle class. So it's just really striking.
But he did give a lot to charity.
Well, less than he could, right. So that he could keep that number up. I mean, right? I mean, so the what's really at stake in the discussion of Mitt Romney's tax returns isn't his, whether he's personally a good or bad person. I mean, I'm sure that there are debates to be had about the way in which he's handled his finance, including whether he's using offshore tax shelters and the like. But, I mean, really the fundamental issue is that over the generation in which we've seen this massive hyper-concentration at the top of income, in which we've seen very modest gains for most Americans, and which culminates in this massive financial crisis, over that period we've seen just the effect of tax rates on the richest people plummet, and this is a bipartisan long-term development, but it's really one that we have to address. We have to figure out how we have a society in which we produce you know, shared prosperity and not just gains at the top. So, I mean, to go back to what you were saying about the fundamental political contrast and issue here is that, you know, to my mind, there's a self-reinforcing vicious cycle that's taking hold, that people don't have faith in politics, that there's a real imbalance in donations and in political influence, and that feeds into the kinds of policies we're talking about. You know, those at the top are much more worried about interest rates right now. They're much more worried about inflation than they are about jobs. Most Americans want to get the job market going again. They're much more worried about taxes, whereas most people are quite happy to see the Bush tax cuts expire for the wealthiest. And above all, they seem to be, you know, there seems to be this kind of collective freak out among corporate and economic elites today that somehow they're not being properly acknowledged for their job creation and their contributions to society. And I mean, this really is a departure from the understanding that we had of how an economy worked, a generation ago, where the idea was that it was a broad effort. And that's really what Nate and I were trying to do in Prosperity Economics, is to show, based on the evidence, that it's not just those at the top that create broad-based prosperity. It's really the contributions of everyone who's working hard, who's trying to better themselves, who's investing in their own skills, who is raising children who can be productive. And it comes, yes, also from government investment and government rules that make sure that the market works well over the long term to translate this enormous productive capacity of capitalism into broad gains, real growth that is sustained and that is broadly shared for all Americans.
Now, I want to get to this part about it, because this is what is sort of fascinating. I mean, I was reading one of the quotes from the report that you put out, where you write about society, basically what you've been saying: society is to cultivate a broad distribution of the returns from increased social wealth, also flourish economically. When all members of society share in the rewards of advancement from better health to greater political freedom, from basic economic security to greater upward mobility, society is more likely to prosper in a sustained way. The thing that occurred to me was that the problem is that it seems, I don't know what the actual figure is, but about half of the country, let's say, maybe less, probably a little bit less, just simply from an ideological standpoint, just doesn't think that this is the role for government. Like, this isn't, you know, it seems, when I read that, it seems to me that this agenda to have a broad base of economic growth that helps as many people as possible is an obvious goal of why you would organize as a society. There seems now to be an ideology, almost like a cultural identification of people who believe, like, no. Maybe if we get there, that's great. But the real point of government is just to let business do what business does. I mean, from a political scientist perspective, and maybe even less the scientist, how do we deal with that? I mean, because that seems to provide the cover for this austerity and deficit fetish.
Well, Sam, I'm sorry, but you were cutting in and out there, but I got the gist of the question. So forgive me if I cut out in my answer. You know, I think you're absolutely right to ask that question. You know, when we look at this incredibly polarized political landscape, where, you know, no matter what Mitt Romney says, whether he starts saying that, you know, 99% of Americans are freeloaders, that he's going to still get, you know, 40 to 45% of the vote, in the worst case scenario. That suggests, you know, that there's this deep-seated hostility towards government. But when you start to look beneath the numbers, what you find is, first of all, there is a huge hardening of the partisan lines. But on concrete economic issues, such as whether we should preserve Social Security and Medicare and as close to their present form as possible, and try to contain costs within Medicare rather than shift those costs, taxes, if you ask whether or not we should let the Bush tax cuts expire for those at the top, whether or not we need to have effective financial regulation. On those issues, you get much broader agreement. So I think what's happened is there's a real loss of faith in government in the abstract, and that's important, because if you don't believe that your political system can effectively address issues, if you don't have faith in political leaders and their capacity to deal with the problems in your own life, then you're very likely to either tune out or vote for the guys who are attacking Washington most aggressively. But I wouldn't go to the point of saying that there really isn't broad agreement or broad grounds for agreement among Americans on some of these central issues that we put out in Prosperity Economics. I mean, we don't discuss all of the polling, but it's pretty clear that on each of these individual items, from infrastructure investment to improved college education, there's broad support. The problem is really the politics. The problem is really the polarization of our political elites. The activist community on the right that is incredibly intense and extremely anti-governmental, and really professing a view that you might call, you know, Ayn Rand economic conservatism, that says that there really isn't anything productive that government can do, and in fact, most Americans really are not contributing to the economy. It's an irony, since I would guess a lot of the Tea Party members would fall into the groups of people that don't pay income taxes because they're elderly or military personnel or have low incomes. But that's the reality, that's become this kind of almost fundamentalist economic doctrine on the right.
Yeah, and I would say, I would go even further. I would say that the other irony is that while you have 70-75% support of leaving Medicare and Social Security untouched, the desire to cut seems to cross party lines. I mean, I'm very concerned about the grand bargain. The worst news I think we had all week was the idea that a couple of Republican senators are saying that maybe they could live with tax increases, because that seems to give a green light to those who want to follow this Simpson-Bowles letter, the prescription laid out in to cut Medicare, to raise the retirement age, raise the eligibility age for Medicare, to chain the cost of living to the CPI for Social Security. What explains that from your perspective, having at least some probably better notion of what is on the minds of even those in the Democratic Party, the president, who feel that it's necessary to take these steps?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on. One is that there is, alongside this hyperpolarization, there's the rise of, the sort of austerity crowd, folks who believe that the deficit is the defining national issue and that the true sign of political courage is calling for shared sacrifice, when shared sacrifice usually means maybe modest tax hikes on the richest alongside really serious cutbacks in the major sources of economic security that most Americans enjoy. There is almost a kind of religious, non-empirical quality to this, because, if you look seriously at the problems in Social Security or in Medicare, in both cases, probably the most effective way we could deal with their long-term fiscal problems is actually strengthening their basic social insurance character. That is, making them, in the case of Medicare, reducing the role of the private plans within Medicare, which costs more, and really trying to put in place serious budget controls within the program, not shifting those costs onto those who receive Medicare, probably expanding the role of Medicare beyond the old elderly to make there be a real public option for the non-elderly. And with regard to Social Security, there are no private defined benefit pensions left in the private sector that are being offered. They're really now mostly enjoyed by public sector workers and those who got them in the past. So Social Security is actually a lot more important, and probably what we need to do is to actually create a kind of supplement to Social Security. That's what we argue in the report, that it is available to make sure that people have a secure retirement benefit, even as private sector benefits decline. So, and those are both popular options. So I think the sort of austerity call is driven, by a sort of sense that there's this sort of bipartisan sense, driven in part by the fact that those at the top, think of the deficit as a much greater threat than unemployment, because they're not personally experiencing it, and because they are, exercised about the threat of government growth and interest rates going up or inflation going up in the future. And that's affecting both parties. And the reality, though, is that if we look forward, the post-election bargain that is likely under the current political situation is one that's going to be very tilted towards towards austerity and away from growth, away from broad-based prosperity.
I mean, in fact, this is all, to contextualize this conversation, winner-take-all politics, this is, in many respects, what it's all about, is that our government has been sort of following measures that are driven by an elite consensus, I guess, that has sort of tilted many political decisions in their favor, and this is a self-fulfilling cycle, I guess, a feedback loop where it begins to make our decisions made by our government less and less democratic.
Yeah. I mean, it's a feedback loop in two senses. I mean, one is if you get a bunch of policies like financial deregulation that vastly enrich a segment of society that has massive lobbying power, then it's really hard to change those rules. It's really hard to push back against that privilege. And that's, both parties. First of all, both parties were implicated in the massive wave of deregulation that led to the financial crisis, and both parties have had difficulty supporting serious reform, though clearly the Republican Party has decided that it's going to basically say that everything's good here. We just need to go back to the system that exists prior to Dodd-Frank. And the other force of the other way in which there's feedback is more subtle, but I talked about it before, and that's just the sense of disillusionment that Americans feel about the political system. And I was struck by the fact that, first of all, Obama came in with very high expectations and hopes, and even though he had gained just over a majority of the vote, if you look at the initial polls about him, there was a lot of goodwill wished him by many Americans who felt that he would be able to, was uniquely situated to address the crisis that we were facing. And if you look at the polls since then, particularly the ones taken sort of in 2009 and 2010, just the sense that the federal government isn't working for middle-class Americans, the degree of apathy and anger about the bailout and about the sense of disillusionment about American politics is just rife. And, some of that was unavoidable, right? The right Republican Party waged a huge obstructionist campaign. They were going to do that almost certainly. There were features of the political environment that made it very likely that you would get a lot of backlash. But some of it was avoidable, and there were definitely mistakes made by the administration, and there were definitely smart choices made by their opponents, particularly those who helped mobilize the Tea Party and its protest. And so we're living with the aftermath of that juncture, and that it leads to this horrible catch-22 for those who think that there should be an effective government response, even now, to the ongoing economic hardship that we see out in the country. And the catch-22 is basically that the only way we're going to address these problems in an environment where business is not investing, in an environment in which we still have enormous private debt that's being paid down, is to have the government step in and be more aggressive in trying to get the job market going. But the catch-22 is that our political system is tied in knots and people don't believe that it can do anything. And so I don't know exactly how we break out of it, but I'm pretty sure that that enacting major cuts in Social Security and Medicare is not the way to do it. I actually think that if things continue on the path they're on, I think there's a very good chance that the president will be reelected. And it's possible, given how sharply conservative the Republican Party has become and the campaign has sounded, it's possible that there is going to be a really good election for Democrats. We're still a long way away, and if there is, I think that the challenge should not, the goal of those who benefit from that swing should not be to do a kind of kinder, gentler version of austerity economics, but to really seriously get out there and articulate at least a decade-long agenda for economic renewal for the middle class, and to really pursue those policies. And the irony is that those policies, while they'll be denigrated often as being kind of irresponsible, are actually very fiscally responsible. If we dealt with healthcare costs in a serious way, that would be the number one way we could address our deficit. If we got the job market moving again and got increased the revenues that we're getting from those at the very top, we would be improving our fiscal situation dramatically. And you can look across the Atlantic and see what happened in Britain, where the British Conservatives came in and said, we're going to be responsible, we're going to do shared sacrifice, we're going to get the deficit down with an austerity agenda, and the economy fell back into recession despite the fact that Europe is that that Britain is not, one of the EU countries that have been right. gravely affected by the crisis, fell back into recession. As a result, the deficit is going up again, despite the fact that they're implementing their austerity policies. And so, if President Obama had followed the advice of Republicans, well, he would probably be out of office. But it's pretty clear that, if Republicans had been in office over that period, if Mitt Romney had been our president and pursued the policies that he says he would have pursued, that we would probably be facing a dramatic reversal, far, far greater than anything that you're getting out of, the backlash against Paul Ryan or the 47% right now. And so, but that's what Democrats, that's what progressives have to work with. They've got to work with an environment where their successes are only going to come through really serious mobilization and articulation of a clear alternative strategy to kind of hard right austerity agenda that is continuing to dominate elite debate in Washington.
Right, and to be fair, and I agree with your assessment of this. I mean, President Obama, at least from a rhetorical standpoint, sort of adopted the austerity as a rhetorical. He was talking about we have to tighten our belts too, which of course is ridiculous.
Well, he went through two phases with that. I mean, there's clearly his initial response was one of trying to find agreement and saying tighten belts, but then that failed so miserably, right? The Republicans kept moving the goalposts and they tried to put the full faith and credit of the federal government at risk. They did put the full faith and credit of the federal government at risk. And then of course there was a kind of response to the Occupy Wall Street protest. And so I think the president actually switched, and he's been very successful in part because he pushed the American Jobs Act, his measure to try to help the economy, and because he more starkly drew the lines with Republicans. The question is what's going to happen after the election, right? Which Obama will it be? And, my hope is that the Republicans have really set themselves up. In one sense, there's no question in my mind that if Mitt Romney loses, most conservative Republicans are going to say this was a failure of a candidate or even a failure of moderation.
Exactly. He wasn't conservative enough, and he didn't give a real choice for people to make.
But so they're going to double down. And so I think that you're right that the big concern one would want to have is there going to be this, a grand bargain that would just barely clear the bar of that 10-to-1 ratio that was discussed during the campaign, the Republican nomination fight. Remember when all those Republicans mm-hmm. were up on the stage and they said, would you support a budget package that had $10 in spending cuts for every $1 in tax increases for every $10 in spending cuts, and no one raised their hands? Well, now maybe some Senate Republicans would be willing to support that. That's, basically where the president was during the fight over the debt ceiling. I think in the end he basically said, I wouldn't even insist on letting the tax cuts expire for the richest of Americans. Let's just try to find some ways to raise some funds for this group, maybe close the carried interest loophole that allows people like Mitt Romney to pay 15% tax on their income. But, that is not a reasonable place for those who believe that we need prosperity for the long term to be. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And it's obviously much easier to roll back those any tax increases based upon, just sort of the example than it would be to reinstate benefits under Medicare and Social Security. I mean, that's what sort of keeps me awake at night. My daughter. Just coming in because she can't sleep. But so let me also ask you just this question in the context of growth. Let's assume for a moment that we don't have the political landscape that we have in the next Congress institutes much of what you have laid out here. How does the idea of continued growth and broader base growth dovetail with the idea that in some respects, we're going to have to do something about climate change, and we're going to have to deal with the fact that our source of fuel for growth over the past 70-100 years has been low-cost energy that is no longer low-cost. How do we deal with those two realities?
Well, it's a big part, actually, of the agenda. And I think we make an unconventional choice in the prosperity economics blueprint. We talk about environmental security in the context of thinking about economic security more broadly, because really sustainable growth rests on having respecting the fragility of important aspects of our environment. And I do think that climate change is sort of the greatest threat we face, because it threatens the very sort of basis of our assumptions about capitalism and its performance. So, you know, I think we've typically assumed that if we get, you know, put in place some rules that will protect against the most egregious abuses of the environment, that we'll be fine. But what we know from climate change is that we're talking about a non-trivial chance of a catastrophic event occurring in the not too distant future, and we need to have that priced into a whole range of transactions that people are making in the market. And that, you know, I would say that the truth is, if you look at our longer term energy environment, that, you know, in some ways, if we act now and we put in place reasonable requirements and put a price on carbon emissions, whether it's a carbon tax or some kind of cap and trade system, that, you know, we're actually in a pretty good place to address these problems, but we're not moving that way at all. And the evidence is that if you do that, there are certainly costs involved, and there's distributional effects too, and we shouldn't forget that, but that we're basically falling so far behind other countries in sort of adopting clean energy technology that we're missing out on a huge amount of efficiencies. And so the market is very, very good at figuring out how to minimize costs and maximize benefits within a certain framework. And in the framework we have right now, they don't have to take into account this huge threat to our well-being, to our future. So that is sort of the precondition for addressing this problem, is that we price this into the markets. But it's just the starting point. I mean, a lot of the effort that is taking place right now to think about new technologies and new approaches to growth makes sense, given this almost existential threat we face. But I would just say that that I don't think that is in any way in conflict with the idea of growth. So what I think, if people forget, and if they go back to Adam Smith, they'll realize this, is that when people talk about, you know, a market system producing broader prosperity, they mean a market system in which people have to bear the cost to society of their individual purchasing and production decisions. And so that very basic idea that there are externalities, both positive and negative, to individual economic behavior goes back to Smith and earlier. And we forget it at our peril. And in fact, the true market enthusiasts, the people who really believe that they can, you know, that in a free market, are the ones who recognize that we're, from systemic financial risk to the risk of climate change, that our market is basically not working, and it's not working because the people who benefit from imposing those costs on the rest of society and those risks on the rest of society are the ones who are writing the laws. So we got to get the politics right.
Jacob Hacker, co-author of Prosperity Economics, Building an Economy for All, and of course also co-author of Winner Take All Politics. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me on. Pleasure. Bye.
Bye. All right, folks. That is the first half of our program today. We're going to take a break. Great time to become a Majority Report member at majority.fm. It is your support that keeps this show alive. Today's show would have been maybe just me in a cafe with Jacob Hacker, although probably, I don't know why he would meet me in a cafe, but maybe if I went up to outside of Yale, Student Union, maybe I could just bump into him, and we would just have had that conversation, and you would have never heard it, but for the existence of this program. And so if you become a member today, you can be sure that, you will continue to hear conversations like that. I won't spend so much time in cafes and student unions. I don't know what else. Please, if you can become a member today, much appreciated. Of course, you can support this program in other ways. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade, Coffee, Tea, and Chocolate. 10% discount code, Majority. And don't forget to visit StrangeAngels.com. They are sponsoring this program this month. I don't know if we have any left. I got to double check. We'll give you an update tomorrow. If we do, it's only one or two left. They're giving out free trial memberships to the Majority Report.
You snooze, you lose.
You snooze, you lose, folks. And, of course, you can give us a review on iTunes. You can somebody on iTunes gave us a review, said that I was too angry at our audience for not supporting the show. And so I gave that guy a bad review. I tried to. Is there something you can do to like sort of say like?
I think you could say like this. Either this review was useful or this review was like not good or something. Like you could like rate the review.
Yeah. No. I've just been on bulletin boards, just completely flaming this guy. That's a term from back when we had bulletin boards on the internet. Flame wars.
Someone was wondering on Twitter on Twitter over the weekend who was filling in for you on Up.
Guy looks just like me. Except he's younger and smarter. Folks, you can also buy your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. We're going to take a break. When we come back, give us a call, 646-257-3920. We've got Dan O'Connor. We're going to be I guess it's going to be a little bit of a debate about some of the things we just talked about with Jacob Hacker. I know maybe that's not fair to have a political scientist on who has written a great report on economics before you're engaging in a debate of economics, but what are you going to do?
He was running for an office,
though. Start your
own show. He was running for an office, though, so you think he has this stuff? He has this stuff down pat.
Well, no. I mean, I think he's going to disagree with some of it. We'll see.
That's the Sam strategy.
That's what I do. When I'm
on a Yale professor beforehand for an interview that's basically a briefing.
Right. That's the way. All right, folks. See you in the better half.